And that's what we are trying to do now, is understanding, well, first of all, understanding if in the wild, psychedelic experiences are associated with these changes. And they seem to be. A lot of people reported, we are collecting those data. We have a new study just to look at that, to ask the question, well, have you had health behavior changes as a result of having a psychedelic experience? And if you did, under what conditions? For instance, something as simple as, did you intend to have those changes or they just happened? And then also looking at some of these mechanisms that I've touched upon before, to see if those seem to be operative. So if those things are changing as people go through psychedelic experiences.
Welcome back to the Trip Report podcast, production of Beckley Waves, Psychedelic Venture Studio. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Pedro Teixeira, a researcher studying health behavior change and health psychology at the University of Lisbon in Portugal, and founder of the psychedelic educational nonprofit Safe Journey. About 18 months ago, I came across a paper authored by Pedro, Robin Carhart-Harris, and others titled Psychedelics and Health Behavior Change, about the potential role of psychedelics to assist and promote positive lifestyle changes that are conducive to overall good health. And I thought that this would be an increasingly relevant area for research and practice. Part of my intrigue with psychedelics as therapeutic tools is the wide array of conditions and issues for which they may be helpful. At a time when the dominant paradigm in healthcare is a different pill for every ill, it's intriguing to see an emerging treatment that has been used for centuries and for which people have organically found uses for many different conditions, from PTSD to depression to cluster headaches. Furthermore, the idea that society's most pressing healthcare challenges, chronic diseases, are downstream of environment and lifestyle is an inconvenient truth. And the reality is that we can't ignore the impact of nutrition, exercise, sleep, our social environment, our relationships, and other non-medical lifestyle factors that can be difficult to change. So, can psychedelic-based approaches help people make positive changes, develop greater agency, feel less compulsion? These are the questions that Pedro and his team are researching. In this conversation, we discuss Pedro's research in nutritional science and health activity, the rise of environmental and lifestyle-based chronic diseases, the early years of the field of behavioral psychology, self-determination theory and the relationship between one's perceived competence and their motivation for change, the underlying psychological mechanisms of action in self-perception and health behavior change, the potential power of combining established behavioral interventions with psychedelics, and what we can learn about behavior change following psychedelic experiences in naturalistic settings, and of course the importance of psychedelic public education. And now I bring you my conversation with Dr. Pedro Teixeira.
So, welcome to the Trip Report podcast. Maybe you can just start by introducing yourself and your professional and intellectual journey, however you want to take that.
Sure. Thanks, Zach. Good to be on the podcast. I am a fan. I listen to it regularly, often when I'm running. And so it's nice to meet you and to talk to your listeners. So yeah, I'm based in Lisbon, in Portugal. I've been an academic for most of my professional life in the areas of health behavior change, as we've come to know it. It's an area of health psychology that studies how people change their behaviors in the areas of health. So things like physical activity, diet are the ones that I've been focusing on the most. I've been doing that for quite a while, you know, internationally and also here with a research group, mostly taking a motivational perspective to health behavior change, study this theory of motivation that I can talk about later, that informs how we think about what people do and especially how they do it for the long run. So how these behaviors get to be part of who you are and what you do, which is really what we want with these behaviors, which tend to prevent chronic diseases. And so they need to be there for the whole run. And I don't know, 5 years ago or so, as many of us, I've read Michael Pollan's book. I had no previous experience or contact with any substances besides alcohol. I knew very little about psychedelics, in fact, but I've always been interested, you know, in mental health, in the mind, also for my own personal interest. I've always been curious of my own moods and my own, you know, changes of being, of states of being. And I knew Michael Pollan very well, because my degree is in nutrition. I studied nutritional sciences, so I followed his work for many years. I was fan. I was a, I was a follower of his work, and so when he turned to psychedelics, I immediately caught my eye, and I thought this must be something interesting because this guy doesn't fool around. So I read the book, and it really hit me very strongly. From multiple sides. So I became interested in the science of it, but also at a personal level and also at a social cultural level. It really excited me to learn more about it. And, you know, long story short, I later became a researcher in the field as well, because, you know, it's not hard to make the links between these agents of change that psychedelics seem to be and also the area that I worked with. So at a conference not too far from, you know, in the year, I think 2018, I was entering this session in a conference, and I heard someone say behavior change, the speaker, you know, and for the first time, I sort of linked the two worlds. And since then, I've been exploring it sort of at a research from a research point of view.
Was that at a psychedelic conference that was a topic of behavior change?
Yes, I think it was in Copenhagen or Stockholm. I can't remember. It was late in 2018, I believe. I went to Horizons first, and then I went to that one. And yeah, and I was deep into psychedelics at the point, sort of studying whatever I could do, also writing a bit here for a couple of press articles that I became sort of interested in and started writing for. So yeah, I heard that, and then I started exploring it and thinking about it. And from then on, I realized that the sort of a conceptual paper that linked the two fields was probably a good way to go. I knew one field, I didn't know the other one so well, so I recruited. by that time, I had met some of the my colleagues in that paper, some of the leading researchers in the field. Actually, Chris Timmerman was the first one I met at Horizons, was kind of the first researcher I ever met in this field, and still a friend and a collaborator. And yeah, from then on, we recruited a few other experts in the field, and then we wrote that paper, and that has become sort of the backdrop for some of the work that I've been doing since and also communicating about.
And so that paper, I should just flag for listeners, is titled Psychedelics and Health Behavior Change. It was in the Journal of Psychopharmacology. Is that right?
Correct.
Yep. And some of those co-authors are Matthew Johnson, Chris Timmerman, you mentioned, Roz Watts, Robin Carhart-Harris, a few others from the Imperial team. And, you know, I should say when I first saw it, I had a similar sort of insight. I was like, oh, you know, we're talking about terms like depression or PTSD or really subjective experiences of the human mind or the human condition. And what this kind of posits is sort of the objective, maybe the behavioral, the objective sort of like mirror of internal, emotional, subjective experiences. And this was at a time where I'll kind of see if I can link the two in a way, but I noticed that there was an advent of digital health tools that were emerging to help people track their sleep, their nutrition, their heart rate variability, what they eat, all these kind of things. And it struck me as the future is going to be looking like this combination of subjective rapport and objective measure because of the tools that are kind of increasingly available to us. So anyway, the point I was trying to make and where I want to go now is like, can you give us a picture of like the domain of health behavior change? You use a few terms there, like motivational based and the process of lasting change. And frankly, it's a personal interest of mine because I have my own challenges with implementing, you know, habits or patterns that I want to have stick only to, you know, turn up a week or 2 weeks later and say like, God, I haven't picked up that kettlebell in 2 weeks. Like, what am I doing? So anyway, can you give us a sort of a bird's eye view of the field of health behavior change and what are the different parts of that?
Sure. Yeah. So ever since chronic diseases became the most important areas of health or health and disease, because before we had mostly infectious diseases and they were treated differently, but ever since things like diabetes and obesity and cardiovascular disease became the real major concerns, it was clear to see that most of those conditions were at a behavioral basis. So at the very least, they could be improved by changes in behaviors, you know, and those are the ones that we know. So smoking, alcohol, diet, and physical activity, those are the big four. And if we could increase or improve the rates of those behaviors, a lot of our health problems would diminish and associated costs and suffering and premature mortality and all that. So from then on, you know, researchers start focusing on these behaviors and how they are regulated, individual and in groups, and what are the factors that determine that people are more or less likely to engage in these behaviors. How can that can be facilitated, both from a public health perspective, but also, you know, individually in one's psychology, in one's motivations and things like that. So societies appeared at the time. The Society of Behavioral Medicine is a major one. We later had a very cool one that I was involved in the beginnings, which was the International Society of Behavioral Nutrition and Physical Activity, which is now one of the major societies in this area. So with the purpose of exclusively looking at the behavioral aspects of this area and trying to understand them, and then ultimately with the goal of creating more effective interventions to help people change behavior. So in these things like first, we look at determinants, so what are the factors that are associated or that are more like barriers or function like barriers, so positive and negative determinants as mechanisms of action that then get to be sort of looked at together in theories of behavior change, and there are several, and some of them are a bit more useful when we look at these health behaviors that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. They're not just any behaviors, because these are specific behaviors and have to do with specific determinants. And ultimately, our goal is to, as I said, is to build interventions. Mm-hmm. So because I was trained as an exercise physiologist first and then as a nutritionist or as a my degree is in nutritional sciences, I've always been sort of in touch scientifically with these behaviors. But because I'm sort of a psychology at heart, I like to understand the whys of our mind and behavior, I soon became interested in this field from this psychological behavioral perspective. And so a lot of the work that we do is trying to identify these critical factors, try to identify the best theories, and then try to build that into evidence and theory-based interventions that we then test. And I've been doing this for 15, 20 years. Through the course of this time, I became very interested in a particular theory of motivation. Mm-hmm. It's called self-determination theory. And it's a broad theory of human motivation and development. It's not just a theory of motivation. And we've been studying it for 10, 15 years, trying to understand if the factors that are most critical from that perspective, and I can expand on that, if they are also at work when people are changing their health behaviors. And we've tested a number of those mechanisms. I've written some reviews on the topic, on the areas of physical activity, diet, and obesity for the most part. And yes, we seem to have come to a point where this idea of self-determination, of you being in contact with your own needs and preferences, with you feeling like you are the conductor of your life, feeling that you are somewhat sheltered from a lot of external influences. So it's a sort of a form of internal motivation or intrinsic mm-hmm. motivation, like we often say, even though it's not entirely correct. So some of those mechanisms associated with this concept of self-determination are really important when people change, and especially for the changes to be maintained in time. So anyway, that's just to give you a perspective of the whole field and also what I've been mostly interested mm-hmm. in. And now I'm also trying to understand if some of those mechanisms playing out are also at stake when people are going through these changes induced by psychedelics.
So when you say mechanisms, can you expand upon what that means? Is that kind of like thought processes? Yeah.
Yeah, psychological mechanisms in general. I can give you a couple of examples that are more widely known. For instance, your perception of your own competence or your confidence or self-efficacy in your own abilities. Mm-hmm. It's one of the factors or psychological constructs that have been studied the most, to the extent that we now accept that when people feel confident, when people feel like they can do a certain behavior, that tends to increase your motivation. This other construct, I mean, there are several, for instance, perceived barriers, the opposite. So when you perceive a lot of barriers in your path, whatever your goal might be, for instance, to change your diet, if you perceive that there's a lot of thing in between, there's a lot of barriers that you see are not easy for you to see how are you going to overcome them, whether they are physical barriers or financial barriers or social barriers or cultural barriers. So these are typically psychological constructs that are measured by questionnaires that give us an idea of critical factors that people tend to have change when they change their behavior. So in brief, that's kind of what I mean by mechanisms of action. So when you change those through intervention, so if you make a certain task a bit easier, for instance, when you teach somebody how to read labels, read food labels, all of a sudden it becomes an easier task and you're more likely to feel motivated to change that behavior.
This idea of self-efficacy and perceived barriers is these two high-level mechanisms. Has there been any research to look at those in cases of like depression or anxiety? Or is there a correlation there, or would you say kind of put them in a separate
Yeah, these are more determinants of behavior itself. And then the way we tend to look at this, for looking at health as the main outcome, whether it's physical health or mental health, is that a lot of these factors, if they are associated with changes in health behaviors, you know, ultimately you'll be leading towards a healthier life. So in terms of prevention of depression or treating depression, for instance, exercise is used to treat depression. But then you have to motivate someone to exercise. So it's a bit earlier in the chain, in the causal pathway. So we don't typically associate some of these mechanisms directly with mental health. However, this theory that I was mentioning is very interesting because, as I said, it's not only a theory of motivation, but it's also a theory that explains human development through life and human thriving. Mm-hmm. And so some of those variables say something like self-determination, which is actually named as autonomy or perceived autonomy. So this expression of ownership over your own behavior, this is actually associated with improved mental health outcomes as well.
Yeah.
When you lead your life from a more internal compass, you tend to feel that things are easier, but also it tends to correlate with mental health as well.
And so are there therapeutic modalities or frameworks that are kind of designed to increase autonomy or?
Indeed. So that's actually what we've been doing for the past 10 years is applying or creating interventions that are based on these constructs and based on these theories, and then transforming them into interventions. So the way the intervention is built is in accordance or in following the principles of theory A or theory B, in this case, is the one that I've mentioned. And then we measure to the extent that people are changing behavior, especially in long-lasting ways. And results have been quite positive. And as we see in other areas, such as learning or in business, this theory applies broadly to human behavior.
Of course.
And usually the results are the same, is that when people feel that, you know, that they are the directors of their own life, let's say, to put it very simply, they tend to last longer at those behaviors. They tend to be more creative, more resourceful, you know, less effort is needed to engage in the behavior. As you can see, the opposite of that is when people are struggling all the time, you know, a lot of effort to change whatever it is. You know, but if you see a child at play, when they are completely absorbed in the task, when they are doing something that they really love, usually that doesn't require a lot of energy or that doesn't require the motivation. It's there to begin with.
And so where I want to get to at this point is sort of your thinking and the work that you've done already. And I'm kind of speculating here from my own understanding of it, that these interventions that are, you know, that have been established for autonomy or perceived barriers or what have you, could be like a foundational infrastructure for preparation, integration, intention setting within a psychedelic kind of mode. You know, I just had a conversation with a psychiatrist and we were talking about how the term innovation in the field of psychedelics usually refers to either new drugs or new molecules or kind of analogs that have to go and get tested, or virtual reality or some other technological tool. But it seems like there's, and I'm interested in your perspective on this, that there's a lot of innovation to be made by the combination of the experience itself, which is, you know, opening, and the term a neuroplastic window is often invoked, in combination with sort of a specific intervention, as you say, towards greater autonomy, towards greater self-efficacy. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes total sense, actually. So we already have behavioral interventions or behavior change interventions in the field of psychedelics. And you know, if you look at smoking cessation work by Hopkins, or the alcohol cessation that now has been starting also, what they're doing is exactly what you're describing. So they're using, let's say, cognitive behavioral therapy interventions, and they're adapting or they're using that template to then create an intervention which is psychedelic assisted. So it's already out there. And they're doing it because they are already established interventions for smoking cessation. So it makes sense to sort of see whether psychedelic or psychedelic experiences might provide an additional impulse or an additional opening that might make those interventions more effective. So the same applies to other behaviors, which are not addictive behaviors. So they are a little bit different because you don't have that aspect of addiction. Although, you know, there might be a lot of similarities in the behaviors that I describe and something like diet or physical activity.
Right.
And so that's the ultimate goal. And I was just presenting at a conference last week in Geneva, a psychedelic conference. And I presented some of this work, and then I put a slide up with a sort of a recruitment advertising for a fake study just for fun, and saying, you know, weight loss, a university-based weight loss study or evidence-based, theory-based weight loss study in university for 16 weeks, including three psychedelic experiences, something like that. So, you know, it's not unlike what MAPS is doing for PTSD. Yep. It's not unlike what Hopkins is doing for these addictive behaviors. So, I mean, that's ultimately what I think we will be testing soon. A few steps to get there, I think, and that's what we are trying to do now, is understanding, well, first of all, understanding if in the wild, psychedelic experiences are associated with these changes, and they seem to be spontaneously. Yeah. A lot of people reported, we are collecting those data. We have a new study just to look at that, to ask the question, well, have you had health behavior changes as a result of having a psychedelic experience?
Right.
And if you did, under what conditions? For instance, something as simple as, did you intend to have those changes or did they just happen?
Right.
And then also looking at some of these mechanisms that I've touched upon before to see if those seem to be operative. So if those things are changing as people go through psychedelic experiences. So something, for instance, like perceived competence. If people feel like they are more confident to make changes in their life, that they feel more capable, and that seems to be reported in a lot of qualitative studies on psychedelics, that people feel this renewed confidence. All of a sudden, what seemed impossible, now it's at hand, stopping smoking or whatever it may be. So we are trying to identify if those critical mechanisms that we know from other areas are important for behavior change are also changing through psychedelic experiences. So that's sort of a middle point sort of set of evidence that we need to collect. And then I think once we do that, if it's, you know, if it's supportive, we will start testing some interventions, maybe some pilot interventions, with a little bit more of an evidence base for these behavior change interventions that have been tested without psychedelics. And we can test them in the context of these experiences, or even the context, for instance, of microdosing. It could be an interesting model to test because you have an intervention that is already out there, that it's already, you know, well established, and maybe, you know, a slight sort of help that microdose may or may not produce. I'm agnostic at this point. Could be something to be tested, or the more classical two or three macrodose classical experiences.
It sounds like the psychedelics and health behavior change paper was sort of a first stab at sort of introducing a concept based on available research that's maybe from the 50s, 60s, combining these two kind of fields of health behavior change sort of at a theoretical level, you might say, right? And now you're in the process of gathering naturalistic survey, maybe analyzing trip reports from Arrowhead or Reddit or whatever to sort of like see if there's a signal within the naturalistic noise. Is that?
That's entirely right? Correct. That's exactly what we are doing. And there's many, as you said, there's many types of study that could be used for this purpose, from qualitative data to survey data to anything in between. And that's exactly what we're doing, trying to get a better sense of this, if this is happening, trying to understand if it is, why it's happening. And ultimately, I think we can look at it in different ways, but one of them is certainly to build interventions that might be more effective than the current ones for changing these behaviors. Of course, another perspective to look at this is to look at it from a more naturalistic perspective, to see if these things are operative in the population as they become experienced, if this has an impact on their health later on in life. So what I've been calling like preventive psychedelics or psychedelics for prevention, which you start hearing about here and there, but it's still a long shot because of all the, you know, all the problems with naturalistic use, of course. But it's not hard to conceive that if these things are operative throughout the course of one's life, and if this helps people lead healthier lives, you know, it's not hard to see how this will have an impact later on in not only mental health, but also in physical health, what I call behavioral health.
So where in this journey of this sort of middle phase of research are you? Like, do you have a paper coming out? Or also, I know you're writing a book, I believe, at the moment. What's your current work environment and projects look like?
Yeah, the book is more of a, I'm on a sabbatical, right, to write a book, sort of an introductory book about psychedelics in Portuguese, which is it'll be the first one in this language for a broad audience. There's some nice manuals for professionals, and this is a sort of a side project. But our research group currently are doing exactly what you've mentioned before. So we have several studies ongoing. We're collecting data as we speak. The first one that we started with was that it's actually a study that it's already been going for 4 or 5 years, the ceremony study with Imperial. So I've joined the study as a researcher, and we are doing naturalistic data collection here in Portugal, but also throughout the ceremony study database more widely in the Netherlands and other countries. What we've done is we've added some measures to the study. So we can study these motivational and self-regulation predictors that we are interested in. And also we've added some more behavioral measures. So it's a very simple study in a way, because these retreats are happening. These occasions are happening out there in the wild, often underground, as we know. And what we do is we get in touch with participants beforehand. We ask them. That's what the study has been doing now for many years. There's many nice papers that have come out of that study. And we're using that same template to study health behavior change that are occurring in the wild, but also looking at these predictors, looking at these factors, motivational factors, and also other psychological self-regulatory factors that we've been using before, and seeing if those are changing. So that's as close to an intervention study as we've come. But then we have survey data that we are collecting at different protocols. So a couple of interesting ones. We are replicating a study that has been done in Spain and the Netherlands, looking at ayahuasca users and looking at their health and health behaviors, comparing that with the norms in the population from those countries. So, of course, some limitations in this work. There's our self-selected samples. We don't know what the population of ayahuasca users really is. But in these countries, they've collected data from over 200-300 regular ayahuasca users. They asked them about their health, about their perceptions of health, well-being, and also health behaviors. And now, as they were compared to the population norm, the population average, what we've seen, what our colleagues have seen, and this is a study led by ICEERS, a Spanish organization, what they've seen is that ayahuasca users are actually healthier. They have less disease, they use less medication, they are more active, they eat better. So, of course, you know, we don't know in which direction this is going. It could be the other way around, that they're already helpful to begin with. Right. But we're assuming that, our colleagues are keen in saying that at the very least, we can say that ayahuasca is not damaging people's health. But I think it goes beyond that. So we are replicating that in Portugal, and the data seems to be, seems to be going in the same direction. So that's another study. We have another one where we're actually asking practitioners, we're asking facilitators, guides, what's their experience in this area? So have they, in themselves and in their clients or patients, have they seen changes in the areas of health behavior that we're interested in? And also asking them about their perceptions about the whys. Why are people changing their behaviors from their perspective? So they're really in the field. They have the best experience of us all, because they've seen hundreds of people going through these experiences. Mm-hmm. And we're asking them, are people talking about it before? Are people talking about it during? sometimes these themes can come up as people are journeying. But especially, are you observing these changes as people are going through integration? Yeah. And we know that often cases people are reporting, well, I all of a sudden don't like to eat meat anymore, I can't smoke anymore, or things like this. That's another study. And finally, we have a broader survey that we are working in partnership with Johns Hopkins and others, where we are just starting to collect data more broadly for users generally. So it's the typical question, you know, have you used psychedelics in your life? Have these changes occurred? Tell us what was going on. So in what circumstances, with what substance, we don't know, even if there are substances that are more prone to this or not. Yeah. So we're looking at it from different perspectives. As you said, we also have some studies looking at Reddit posts and spontaneous posts, and seeing if people are reporting these changes just spontaneously out there.
Interesting.
So it will take another 2-3 years, I think, before we can start. Maybe some of the papers might be starting next year. I have a PhD student that is working hard on it. But it might take us another couple of years to start sort of putting this out there for peer review and for others to see. So I'm hoping that this research would also trigger other colleagues that might be interested in starting similar projects.
And so within this roadmap of this area of research, how far off do you see clinical evaluations of these types of interventions?
Yeah, to be honest, I mean, it'll take. I think the key aspect here is that more researchers are interested.
Yeah,
you know, as we are testing smoking cessation trials, there's no reason why we wouldn't be able to test already, say a weight loss trial, an obesity prevention, or people that have pre-diabetes that need to change their behaviors fast because they are turning into people with full diabetes. They're out there to be conducted already, because as Hopkins have done, there's already different lines of evidence suggesting that these things might be helped by psychedelic experiences. Yeah. I'm not in a rush to do intervention studies. We've done a lot of those in the past. They're very hard work. Also, of course, when you're using psychedelic substances, it takes a certain a certain type of protocols and requirements that in my school, at least, we're not ready to do. but I'm hoping others will be inspired and start doing it soon.
Interesting. So this lends me to two other places I want to take our conversation. You have a project, I'm not sure if it's a nonprofit or an organization, called Safe Journey. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what that is and tell us about that project.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed public education, communicating science to the public. I've done that for many years. I've been involved in public health in the past as well, besides my academic work. So there's always it's been this interest. And when I started sort of researching psychedelics and learning about it, I actually wrote a long newspaper article in the major newspaper in Portugal about psychedelics. And from then on, some interviews came up, and then all of a sudden there was interest in the press about the topic. This was 5 years ago. There wasn't much out there on psychedelics at the moment. So having this professor that all of a sudden, you know, is interested in psychedelics, and I was also open about my own experiences to some degree that I had at that point. So it was a little interest. So all of a sudden we had some resources out there for people to read if they want to read more about it. I just decided to put all that somewhere online. But from then on, you get excited, and we decided to build a website that we called Safe Journey, where we would post, you know, information in Portuguese mostly about what was going on in psychedelia overall, the psychedelic renaissance. And then, you know, it grew, a lot of people became interested, some of my friends joined. It's still a very laid back type of project, but it's become sort of a central reference point in Portugal, in Portuguese, for disseminating valid information about psychedelics. Mm-hmm. We've now started organizing public events as well as mm-hmm. online events, and we're moving into helping health professionals also enter the field and get connected to people that are looking for mental health professionals to work with. Mm-hmm. In preparation and integration. So it's growing. It's a grassroots type of organization, very laid back, very informal, that we all work for in spare time from our regular jobs. But it's been very interesting because it allows us to connect with the public and to see where the energy is going in this respect, how many more people are interested. It's been amazing in the last 4 or 5 years how many people became interested in the
So is it largely like kind of an education, harm reduction, best use kind of thing, trying to mitigate negative outcomes and inform people about if they're going to be, because this is where the rubber hits the road, in my opinion, right now. Like all of the science, all of the drug development companies, all of the policy efforts that get the media attention, and it's building this snowball effect of interest, of curiosity, and of demand. And sanctioned and legal opportunities are not able to meet the demand that they're creating in this context. And so at the same time, they're wildly freely available, basically. You know, anyone can, you know, within 2 or 3 degrees of separation can find, you know, access to psilocybin or LSD or what have you. And so it's particularly salient right now because of a recent, you know, news event where a pilot in America had a bad reaction and attempted to cut fuel to the, anyway. And I don't know how to think about this, right? Like, I don't know how to have an opinion on the concept of decriminalization and sort of, you know, prohibition does not work from a public health perspective. And yet a decriminalization or an emancipation of access at this point will create a surge, even more of a surge of demand. And these things are not without risk, right? Like I talked to Jules Evans from the Challenging Experiences Project, and he just published a paper about extended difficulties. And so, you know, it's estimated that somewhere between 10 and 13% of people will have some sort of longer term anxiety, cognitive issues, or even depersonalization, derealization. And so I guess I'm like I said, I don't know how to think about this from a what to do perspective. To me, it feels too complex, too nuanced, too subtle, and just feels like a series of trade-offs that is impossible to get right. You know what I mean? But it sounds like Safe Journey kind of fits into this category of information on best practices that inform, educate, and mitigate risk feels like the most important thing right now, right? And that's not coming from federal governments. That's not coming from drug developers who have to keep a very narrow focus and eye on the ball. And so it feels like a very grassroots, bottom-up type of effort. And what do you make of all that?
Yeah, it's very current, as you say. I'm also aware of the work of the project you mentioned and Jules. I read his posts regularly. So we also feel in that tension. So from in the beginning, say 4 or 5 years ago, our goal was really to get people in the field, to attract people to pay attention, to see the potential, to perhaps even start their own sort of road into this field, and also attract the attention of health professionals, which were removed from the area, of also politicians and all that. But so that was our beginning. And now progressively, as more people are entering this field and becoming interested and wanting to experiment, of course, we're moving more towards what you're mentioning, which is really to be focusing on educating, creating a good base of literacy in the population that allows them to navigate this space that, as you mentioned, on the one hand shows the promise, but on the other hand, legally you cannot access these experiences in a safe environment unless you have this condition. And even if you have these conditions, it's still not accessible today. So it creates obviously this tension of a lot of people being interested, but potentially sort of in using it in contexts that are not safe or not maximizing harm reduction. So you're totally, I agree with you. And that's why I feel our role is more and more important as time goes by, which is, I think, public education, increasing people's knowledge and literacy about these experiences, harm reduction, and also creating good consumers, which is something that's not to mention. So as people, sort of, for instance, are scouting the field looking for retreats, for instance, are looking for facilitators, that they know what to ask, that they know what they should expect and not, not settle for less, because there's no regulation. So it's, mm-hmm. These settings are regulating themselves. So the more that we know what to ask, the more they will provide a good service. So that's one of the areas that I think is universally accepted as useful at the time that we're speaking. Now, the conversation about risk and benefits is one that I've been also thinking a lot about, especially as the Challenging Experiences Project has become more vocal and now there's some data out there. Because on the one hand, I also feel that we live in a kind of a bubble, the psychedelic community. We think that everybody out there is sort of into our scene and that everybody's wanting to try. I mean, if you look at the stats, it's a very small group of people still.
I know.
On the other hand, if you survey the population at the moment, what you'll find is that the large, overwhelming majority of people are still carrying the stigma and the fear and the prejudice that resulted from this, 40, 50 years of misinformation. And that's something I'll discuss with Jules at some point. We're actually wanting him to come to Portugal and participate in one of our sessions, because I think that, it's great that scientists and clinicians are very in tuned and very interested in the difficult experiences and the risks and the what can go wrong. And avoid them, and of course study them so we know the most. And I think that's a great project to, in this great example. On the other hand, I think when you speak to the public, I think every piece of information that is perceived as reinforcing the stigma that people already have is going to, it will turn off or prevent so many people from even paying attention to this field, because it will reinforce this idea that, okay, pilots are with mushrooms, I don't even want to get close. And I think you're hearing a lot about challenging experiences now, and as if people were not paying attention to the field. I think we were. And I think we might go overboard with this idea and actually, prevent more people to even become interested in the field and then decide what they want to do with a fair assessment of risk benefits. So I think a good communication about risk, because actually, if you read Jules Evans' paper carefully, and if you read the other data, there's a lot of data out there on challenging experiences, actually. Yeah. You'll see that, of course, these events are rare, but mostly what you see is that they are very easy to mitigate. When you see the risk factors for these, if we know how to deal with alcohol, which is actually much more complicated, we can learn easily how to deal with these experiences from a population perspective. So
totally.
I think we need to balance the information, not get over carried away with, now it's really risky and people shouldn't get close.
I know. It feels like sailing, apparently, like I'm not a sailor, but apparently you can't go a straight line in sailing. You have to kind of go zigzagging and you get off course and then you got to recorrect. But the thought that I had just as you were talking there is, and I mentioned this to Jules yesterday, there's a phenomenon and I'm familiar with it in in the world of like the treatment of chronic pain, for example, whereby, you know, the nocebo effect can be delivered from a healthcare provider that provides, you know, overly or fear-inducing kind of explanation of like an injury. So for example, like chronic low back pain is actually one of the biggest public health costs that we have in the world. And oftentimes, trying to get just give a very simple explanation, when somebody gets an explanation like they have a slipped disc, right, that creates a sort of a conception in their mind of what is happening in their anatomy, which changes their behavior, which changes their threat perception, which changes all of these things that directly add fuel to this fear-based cycle of chronic pain. And so I was actually had the thought last night, and I don't want this to come off as like flippant, but how can informed consent be detrimental? By which I mean, like, what ways of describing potential risks enhance their likelihood? Does that make sense? Is that
That's a bit of what I was talking about a bit further down the road, as people are experiencing and they are hearing about all these things that can go wrong. Like when we read the adverse effects on a medication, the list is endless.
Right.
You might get, oh my God, you know, this, I might get one of these. And actually the odds of that happening is very, very rare. So it's kind of the same thing. And I don't know if there's any research on this, to be honest. Yeah. It's not exactly my area. But I think we have that risk. And as I was saying, because people are already so primed to the negative effects of drugs, generally speaking, and outside of the bubble of psychedelics, which is where most people are, you know, let's remind ourselves that we are still talking to a population that is largely unaware of psychedelics, but they are very aware, wrongly, of the risk of drugs. And so they will use any of these information that we are talking about. I know the risk of, you know, of having a traumatic experience or having a long-term sort of mental health issue, which is very, very rare instances. And actually the data, the percentage you were talking about before, it's already within a sample that reported difficult experiences. So if you look at the cumulative of data in adverse effects, even in a while where you know, we don't know what people are doing, it's relatively low. And actually, I think it's very comparable to other areas of life. You know, living is, you know, there's risk for almost everything. Yeah. And we don't create, you know, harm reduction public policy campaigns for horseback riding or for, you know, swimming in unobserved, whatever it may be. So I think we need to start using this behavior or this area in comparison with other areas and communicating risks and then acting accordingly in a, as you say, in a very balanced way. Because I think, putting it very bluntly, I think the risk of preventing people from even approaching this field, what we know about the potential of these substances, of these experiences, from my perspective at least, the risk of preventing more people to even getting, you know, interested in the field, I think it's a higher risk to me than the risk of these rare instances as people approach and maybe they're not ready. But that's a very, you know, that's a very maybe controversial statement. But
no, that makes complete sense to me. Yeah, it makes complete sense to me because, like, you know, I heard somebody, I hope I'm going to reiterate this correctly, like, and it was in the context of the FDA and their approval process, right? They have type one error, which is approving a drug where the risk-benefit profile is not advantageous. And so that's one type of error. The other type of error is the delay or the wait time or the inability to get a drug over the line that would have so much more benefit than if it weren't. And so
scientists are quite used to type one and type two errors.
Yeah.
We assess it in all studies. And it's the risk of not finding a positive result. Type two error, that's what it is.
So I just mentioned the concept of chronic pain. And before we connected, I was not aware that this was an area that you were interested in. And it's an area that I have a deep fascination about. I don't know if I relayed, but I'm an acupuncturist by training. And so I've been in private practice for about 8 years until 2 years ago, where I'm now doing this full time. But in that role, chronic pain was my bread and butter. And what I learned in that experience and that I think is relevant here is that there is I don't want to use the word paradigm shift, but there is a paradigm shift in their sort of understanding of the mechanism of chronic, persistent, long-lasting pain, whereby the common conception is that there is an injury in my shoulder or a tear or inflammation that is just not healing. Whereas this new paradigm of understanding is that, you know, tissue may have healed, but pain persists because the quote unquote lesion has moved into the nervous system. And so the brain and the central nervous system has always learned like the pain signal.
Well, I'm actually not an expert in pain, Zach. I gave a talk once. I was asked and I reviewed the evidence, but actually chronic pain is not my area at all. So I wouldn't be able to expand a lot on what you were saying.
Okay, fair enough. But I saw your presentation and I'm curious, just can you give us the high level summary of that and like what the evidence suggests? Because it strikes me as not too dissimilar from behavior change. And I'm curious how you think about that and what led you to look into this.
Yeah, well, it was an opportunity, to be honest, in a conference, on a pain conference. And that they asked, you know, psychedelics seem to be related to pain. And I dived into the field for a couple of weeks just looking into the evidence. And this was already about a year ago. So let's see if I remember correctly. But yep. Well, the high level is that it's actually one of the areas in physical health that I think psychedelics could be most promising.
Yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily relate it to behavior change, but that's maybe because I don't fully understand the mechanisms of pain. I'm not a pain researcher. But not only the chronic joint pain or chronic pain or actually the fibromyalgia or just the overall chronic pain that some people live with forever, but also headache pain. So pain you had, which can be really, really detrimental to one's health and some that it's almost impossible to live with. I don't fully remember actually the mechanisms that I reviewed at the time. Yeah. I just remember that it was very promising, that the early evidence was pointing in the right direction.
Yeah, totally. And I'll just say like the reason why it's exciting for, like I said, for me is I think that, to your point, there seems to be some evidence from the early era of psychedelic research, which is pointing in the direction, but there's also a handful of studies, phantom limb pain, fibromyalgia, chronic low back pain at Stanford and UCSF. So it seems like there is a port of call here, to your point, like that it could be very effective for a few different reasons. And we talk a lot about mental health and the epidemic of mental health in the psychedelic space. But I think, I don't know if it's larger, I wouldn't want to compare it, but it is an epidemic of chronic pain out there. And the treatment options are limited. And the world of pain medicine, at least in America, is totally fragmented. And it's really pretty ugly from my perspective. So to the extent that there are options that could emerge from this for that use case, I think would be.
I think you could do an whole episode on pain, chronic pain. There's some great researchers out there. If you haven't already, maybe you have already. But at the time, it was very clear, like you say, that this is an area that's going to be very fruitful in years to come.
Where I'm inclined to kind of take us to finish up the conversation, and I'm looking to you to kind of help me understand this. Like, to me, this is the paradox of the psychedelic field, is that, as we just talked about a few minutes ago, like the development of the science and the business and policy front, which is driving a lot of enthusiasm and drawing people to experiment and use these tools, feels very unique. Like, you don't have a cancer drug or a blood pressure medication that's going through the clinical trials that, you know, has a surge of public use outside of those clinical trials, right? And so this is a really unique phenomena in my sort of estimation. And you mentioned some naturalistic and survey-based research, but could you talk a little bit more about how you see, whether it's providers or retreat operators or even just individuals? Like, another thing that's emerging now is the concept of citizen science and decentralized clinical trials and tools that are sort of outside of the normal box of either drug development or academic kind of settings. And I'm curious, are there any unique or interesting projects that you're familiar with that you haven't mentioned already that are trying to evaluate mechanistic or outcomes based but in the real world? Like, maybe this is the question. If you could design a trial in that, what would it look like? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yes. Well, I think the best place to look at this point is really the organ experience and how it develops. Mm-hmm. If you ask me what is the, you know, the having this conversation for lunch today with a friend, what is the most likely sort of first step or the most or setting context in which psychedelics will be used outside of clinical settings, but within a sort of safe, controlled environment, mm-hmm. if you'd like. Mm-hmm. I think it's something that will resemble what's happening in Oregon. So our locations, you can call them retreats or centers or communities, whatever you want to call them, mm-hmm. where there is a mix of regulatory oversight that we are all sort of responsible for as a society. But on the other hand, that provides widespread access for people that want to have this experience outside of the medical system because they don't need or because they are just curious or because they want to explore their, you know, their consciousness. So I think that's, you know, that's the closest I've seen. And what you're asking is kind of the million-dollar question. We don't really know where this is going. Yeah. You know, and if we start thinking about plant medicines like ayahuasca, it's even crazier how this is going to be inserted in society as we know it. I mean, it's really a riddle. I think many bright people are thinking about it as we speak of how mm-hmm. this is going to happen. I don't know. But yeah, I think more and more, as people are creating new environments for using substances, and this is also changing, by the way. I mean, I can think of five or six or seven or eight different reasons and contexts where people are using psychedelics these days that have mm-hmm. nothing to do with clinical settings or really recreational settings, whether it's for couples therapy or whether it is for personal growth or for parenting or for creativity or for, you know, you name it, or for grief, you know, there's all sorts of uses. So it'd be really nice actually to know as people become more literate and they become more autonomous, they become more sort of fluent in this language and more competent on using psychedelics, even if it's underground. I think it would be really interesting to start following these patterns of use, which is still safe use, an informed use, but it's for a type of use that we are not talking about too much. Mm-hmm. And you know, another way to think about this is that, you know, psychedelics have always been around. The medicalization of psychedelics is very recent. And of course, you know, science is what we know today, and it's so influential in society that it's in science and medicine that it's natural that we are sort of focusing on that. But there is this knowledge base that we've been acquiring that somehow needs to be translated to the modern world, and we can investigate how that's happening. And you can look at different substances, different contexts for that, and those are very interesting to study, because what I think we'll find is that the so-called transformative power of psychedelics will become much more apparent as we look at regular people's lives and experiences, and how those can change by using psychedelics, for instance, within communities or within groups of friends, or within certain settings, certain specific settings that I was mentioning. I think another interesting area that I think we need to explore from a research perspective is seeing how this is playing a role in current psychotherapy or psychotherapeutic settings. So I foresee a not too long future, actually it's happening right now, as people that are engaged in psychotherapy, they are sort of having, let's say, experiences on the side, and which are then brought to their psychotherapeutic path. And so that needs to be explored, because I think it's the most safe setting of all when you have a psychotherapist or a therapist mm-hmm. in some sort that is following your development, mm-hmm. your psychological health. And then you have these experiences and then you continue integrating them within the course of psychotherapy. I think that's a wonderful sort of ideal setting for people to be using this in the wild. And that requires also research and knowing how those two fields are being integrated, or are those sort of experiences in the wild are being integrated into normal psychotherapy. Actually, that's how I started using psychedelics. I was undergoing psychotherapy, and then so happened mm-hmm. that, you know, I became interested. And then as I underwent these experiences, I could take them back to my therapist. Yeah. And it was very, very helpful to me. I mean, some things I might have not learned if it wasn't for that process.
Yeah.
So that's another area that I think looking at real world science and what's happening already that we want to investigate. But I'm really curious to see how Oregon's going to play out. I think it was a really bold move from the country where, you know, the war on drugs has been strongly enforced. So I really hope it goes well and that we can collect data on what's happening there and learn from that to maybe adopt in other countries.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what happens there. But I mean, people are using these in context with psychotherapy and probably informal and sort of adjunct ways. And they're the natural kind of space holders for the integration or the preparation process. And so I know there's a handful of projects that, you know, Journey Clinical, one of them kind of being trying to facilitate that. So anyway, I really enjoyed this. This is great to connect and to learn about your work and where it's headed. I'm excited by the prospect of psychedelic assisted behavior changes. I think that's a promising area, and excited to follow along with your work. Where can people connect with your lab or your research group and follow along with your publications and such?
Yeah, I guess the easiest way is probably social media, through my own links, because I post what we do there. And from there, it's easy to look at my my website. But we can maybe put the website of my research group on the podcast.
Have,
and maybe that's a direct link.
There.
We have a page with all of our studies. And then you know, through email, we can connect. And hopefully others would be interested in pursuing this as well.
Yeah, cool. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the time. This has been fun.
Thanks, Zach. Good luck.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the Trip Report. We hope you enjoyed it. You can sign up to receive our free newsletter and get the podcast sent directly to your inbox by going to thetripreport.com. This podcast is a production from Beckley Waves, a psychedelic venture studio. If you're interested in learning more about building companies in the psychedelic space, head over to beckleywaves.com to get in touch. If you like this episode, please give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and share it with your friends. I'm Zach Hegney. The Trip Report is produced by Kula Production Company with coordination from Caitlin Jabari. See you next time.
All right, that was great.